This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us. Talking politics this week. Lots going on, Brandon. But let's start with what I think might be one of the most interesting, troubling, and disturbing stories or visuals I saw all week, Brandon.
It went viral all week. Everyone's seen it.
Ted Cruz's beard, or what he is masquerading as a beard. What is that on his face, man?
I think, when I first saw it, I thought he looks like Wolverine, like this the comic book character, right? It's going for that kind of giant lamb chop kind of a look, which I think could really come back, right?
It's like a chia pet growing on his face. I mean, it was ridiculous. It looks like he's going for kind of a Civil War era thing where he doesn't have the chin. He just has giant mutton chops.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Well, it's all in aid of the No Shave November, right? Which you're also participating in, right?
I am participating, although I, you know, in my wildest dreams, I could not hope to achieve what Ted Cruz has achieved.
By November 2nd, you had already a full beard, so you were like already well ahead of Ted Cruz, right?
Yeah, true. I think he needs a no shave November, December, right. January.
Through the season, right, yeah. Well, hey, let's talk about some substantive politics here. Jay, butt her emails. We have a controversy swirling with Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter. She apparently had sent hundreds of emails last year on a private account, and this is apparently in violation of federal rules on a couple of different dimensions. This was relayed through the private email account, the domain that she shares with her husband. Jay, what is the practical implications of this? Because obviously we've seen this very kind of scandal before. One of the things the president ran on was basically that this was a misuse of power from Hillary Clinton, who did something somewhat similar, although not exactly similar. Is this hypocrisy? What do we call it?
Yeah, I think the chant that was the refrain through much of the campaign, lock her up. And it'll be interesting to see if Democrats, in fact, have talked about wanting to have hearings associated with this. So here, let's talk about it. She used a private email account to do government business, which is a violation of this federal act. The issue, I think, what differentiates it a little bit is, in fairness, Hillary Clinton uses a secure email server.
Yeah.
I think Ivanka Trump used the equivalent of a Gmail account. So this is actually, in many ways, a far bigger issue from a breach perspective. Now, substantively, special advisor to the president versus the secretary of state. From a just weight perspective, we don't know what kind of classified materials, because that's really what's going to come out of this investigation.
Right.
So, I mean, we can make light of it, the hypocrisy around it, kind of whether or not they're equivalent. It's unclear the kinds of emails that she was sending using this account and what she was sending it to. If she was sending it to government employees, asking them about a topic that in a sort of neutral way or in a non-classified way, it may not be that problematic. But if she was asking about substantive things on a non-secure server, that could be really an issue.
Well, the White House reports that it was done fewer than 100 times and that none of the messages contain classified information. Obviously, the hearings are going to come to sort of this with a more clear sense of whether or not this is true. But I think obviously the optics are quite bad for the Trump administration. In fact, she came out and did a CNN interview that basically tried to walk back a lot of this. So that was interesting to me, right? Even though there have been many of these sort of mini scandals that have happened, this has been one where she really got out in front of it. So I think that they can solve this. But I suspect that we're going to see the terminology illegal Ivanka come very soon, right?
Oh, that is, you're going to coin that phrase?
Illegal
Ivanka? I like that. Well, we've had some pretty significant developments in the Robert Mueller investigation, the ongoing Russiagate investigation. President Trump did not meet with Robert Mueller, but actually responded in the form of written answers to questions. Magically, those responses seem to have made it through much of the media outlets out there as to whether or not what he said and how it was written.
Now, remember that the investigation of Bill Clinton, right, there are a lot of leaks that came out of the special prosecutor's office. We don't think that's what's happening here. It's probably from the White House more broadly.
I mean, we know everything that's going on at that White House. I mean, we know details about when the president goes to the bathroom, you know, how much he sleeps a night, what he eats, all these sorts of details that frankly, we shouldn't know.
We don't know that about Eisenhower, so.
Yeah, we don't know that about any president.
Yeah, so that's one issue. I mean, I think, obviously, the constant leaking. I think in terms of how the rest of this is going to play out, it's going to be pretty interesting. Now, Paul Manafort, obviously, is a central player in this. He has essentially been accused by Robert Mueller of breaching the plea agreement, and one of the things that they have suggested that he did essentially was lie to the FBI and the special counsel's office. The terms of his deal say he has to cooperate fully, truthfully, and completely and forthrightly. So this obviously suggests perhaps that this is going to extend for longer if they can't get Manafort to give them good details. I'm suspect here that they needed Manafort's testimony to be able to get more details about who was doing what inside of the Trump campaign. This is a kind of stonewalling tactic, which is pretty common for presidents when they're accused of these kinds of things. So it's not totally out of the question that that's what's happening here, but it definitely extends this chess game.
Yeah, my take is a little bit different on this. What I thought was interesting was that the investigative team, Mueller's team, knew immediately about the veracity of the statements. That implies that they have some sort of corroborative witness and or evidence that can essentially back up or confirm what Manafort is saying is true or false. The second element to me, I think, is that there may be a situation where they are deeply concerned and they found out about this, that Manafort has been essentially compromising and sharing information that he has been giving to the special investigator with Trump's personal lawyers, which I think is not normally the case with cooperating witnesses. So you've got these two elements floating out there. I think they know exactly what Manafort said, what's true and what's not. On a similar taking of what's true and what's not, we had sort of the big story, I think, of this week has been the pleading guilty by Michael Cohen, the president's personal lawyer. And in it, Michael Cohen acknowledged that he had spoken much more extensively to President Trump about the Trump Tower project in Moscow. And this is something that's pretty kind of a big shift. It means that the president was much more aware of a project that he probably should not have been aware of.
Yeah, and these are the kind of things that I'm definitely sort of believe that we're going to find out in hearings. The question about how and when to do specific kinds of hearings for the House Democrats is going to be, I think, one of the more vexing that they're going to deal with. Does it complement the Mueller investigation? Does it, to some degree, supplement it? We'll see how that plays out. But this is going to be one of those topics which is not going to go away. And this creeps ever closer to the president. And I think that's really exactly what they don't want to happen. But we're going to see some fireworks, I think, after the start of the year.
Well, you know what else the administration's been trying to make go away? Is a climate change report, Brandon. You know what?
1,600 pages,
right? 1,600 pages. You know what? I have a good idea. Let's put it out on the Friday after Thanksgiving.
That's good.
Maybe no one will notice.
People are too, hungover from turkey and wine and Black Friday shopping to notice that this report is really impactful, right? It says essentially that major parts of the U.S. economy will suffer hundreds of billions of dollars in annual losses by the end of the century unless global greenhouse emissions are substantially reduced. So, Jay, we've seen evidence of this in Texas alone, hurricanes, flooding, wildfires. So these are the kind of things that have a tremendous economic effect as well as a effect on our health, right? The harmful ozone levels increasing, air pollution spiking, people's asthma and respiratory issues increasing. So there's a lot of things going on in this report that are potentially problematic and troublesome down the road.
Right. The big impact, I think, of the report was that it couched it in terms of economics.
Yes.
Right. Just for the first time, what it talked about is a structural permanent reduction of the GDP, the gross domestic product, by more than 1% going forward as a direct result of climate change.
Yeah.
That is a huge, huge issue. Because the traditional argument from folks that tend to debunk this is the idea that, well, it's going to hurt the economy.
Yeah, well, too expensive to control.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Too expensive to control. It's going to hurt the economy if we make big substantive changes to try to combat climate change. This essentially sort of flies in the face of that and makes the fundamental argument that we have to do it in order to preserve our economic integrity.
Yeah. Well, the president said he doesn't believe, right? Like, flat out. The reason that he doesn't believe it is probably political in part, but this is interesting because it's a kind of separation of powers at work, right? This report is required by Congress and is funded by Congress, and so we see the separation of powers at work here. But I do think we're going to continue to see the president making these kinds of claims, right? Because in part, they have really tried on the administrative side of things, which I think you would rank in the top five of things the president has done well to sort of please the base, to undo some of these Obama-era environmental regulation. So they're using this basically as a ballast to that.
The irony of the president's position is that the Trump organization itself, in the way it manages golf course property, real estate development deals, recognizes, and in all of their documentation, the issues surrounding climate change, and talks about it as part of their water management process,
wow.
Talks about it in terms of how they recycle and how they develop in a way to minimize the impact to the climate, all at the same time as the president is debunking this.
Wow, interesting. Well, let's talk about more kind of president versus White House. And we've had here a week where the president has lashed out, hit his own Federal Reserve chair. Jay, what's going on?
President Trump has taken Jay Powell, the current Fed chairman, a bit to the woodshed, being highly critical of the way he's been handling the economy, saying he keeps raising interest rates, trying to stall an otherwise robust economy. And this also comes out in the perspective that he had met extensively with Janet Yellen, the predecessor, really liked her, thought about extending her, but decided against it entirely because he was bothered how short she was.
Right, which is, you know, a common failing for economists, I think you would note, right? How many tall economists are there, right?
Well, apparently, I think the phrase he uses, she just doesn't look like she could be the Fed chair. Keep in mind, she had been Fed chair for the previous 4 years.
Yeah, for a pretty good economy. Now, look, Trump's got a pretty good economy, right? I mean, the growth is about 3.5%, which is pretty good. Inflation is relatively in check. Now, the Fed Reserve chair basically, I don't know if he succumbed to pressure exactly, but he did say that the economic indicators of the benchmark for inflation were just below where they needed to be to raise rates. So the rates will basically be flat where they were. So I'm not sure if the pressure worked, but it's not like uncommon for Fed chairs and presidents to have this kind of conflict. In fact, George H.W. Bush, when asked why he lost the 1992 election, said two words, Alan Greenspan, because Greenspan would not lower the rates, and as a result, basically, the economy stayed pretty bad. This is not just kind of blustery Trump lashing out at people. His election hinges on solid economic performance, and if things aren't going well in the next year, then it could be real problematic for him to get reelected.
Well, the Federal Reserve Bank system was created with the idea that the Federal Reserve Chair would always have a certain level of independence in this process.
Yeah.
We've seen it historically. Their fundamental mission is to control inflation. That is why they exist. It comes out of the Great Depression and issues of trying to combat hyperinflation and things like that. And so there's real concern about the fact that we have a white-hot economy, plus 3% growth now for multiple quarters, which is a great thing.
Yeah.
But we're also doing it with massive injections of deficit spending.
Yeah.
The structural deficit of the U.S. government now is in excess or approaching $1 trillion a year. So if we go into a tailspin, we're not going to have the ability to go out there and actually inject more money into the process. Interestingly enough, the president apparently has been talking about trying to encourage the Federal Reserve Chair to print more money, I think was his phrase.
Yeah. Well, Jay, you know what else is scary? It's unusual because obviously the holiday season after you pass Halloween shouldn't be frightening, but it turns out that maybe it is a little bit. Melania Trump, the first lady, has apparently gotten a lot of pushback on her what people are deeming spooky holiday decorations at the White House. What do you make, Jay, of these bizarre red trees?
It was like the Addams Family Christmas, right? The Shining, you know.
The Shining.
The Shining. It did kind of have like a Shining vibe to it. Yeah, so if you can imagine a hallway, long hallway, with a set of red Christmas trees, blood red Christmas trees with no ornaments on them, and her stoically walking through them. That is the visual of Christmas that apparently the Trump administration wanted to put out.
Right. People are deeming this scary and ominous and have referred to it as the hallway of Yuletide murders. This looks like a bad horror movie as opposed to like a happy holiday decoration. In fact, this last year, last Christmas, the Bush Library in Dallas had an event and they had like a decoration of all the different ways that holidays had been decorated at the White House in the past. And they were all perfectly tame, very normal, very tasteful. And then we have this, which looks so different. I encourage our listeners, pause this, bookmark it, go and look at this because it is really unusual. And I don't know if it's like art that I don't get or if it's just something that's totally bizarre or what.
Can you imagine Laura Bush putting out blood red Christmas trees
exactly.
in the middle of the White House? Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Bushes, let's shift a little bit gears back home, Texas politics.
There you go.
Our Attorney General Ken Paxton got a bit of a win, didn't he, on his ongoing criminal case that is still out there? What happened there,
Brent? Yeah, while the gravy was still congealing during Thanksgiving week, at the end of that, we had a very important ruling from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which basically suggested that the prosecutors had been overcharging the government and were supposed to have been paid an hourly rate, or should have been paid an hourly rate instead of the amount of money they were paid. So the issue here, I think, is a couple of fold. I mean, number one is the delay potentially in the trial for Ken Paxton, right, who still has these charges against him, these two first-degree charges of felony securities fraud. But the second, Jay, and this is to me more important, is that there's a potential chilling effect of the prosecution of public officials who have done wrong. These are expensive cases to run, and essentially, the bill to date is about $500,000 for these two prosecutors. What you're talking essentially about, also Ken Paxton, who's got a bevy of lawyers. This is a complicated and interconnected case. If it's the precedent going forward that counties are not able to or unwilling to pay for this, then it could prevent, I think, the justice from being done when people do wrong.
Well, I take a slightly different view on it. I think this is not that uncommon to see downgrades in terms of the amounts awarded.
Mm-hmm. You're saying lawyers should be paid less?
Always. I say this as a lawyer. They should be paid less. Yes. But since you're married to a lawyer, I think you should be more sensitive about
right,
this.
Right. No, I'm totally against it, right?
Yeah. But this is not that uncommon. I don't know if it's going to have a chilling effect. I mean, I think the issue is he's still going to be prosecuted. The indictment still stands. They're still going to move forward. The real question, I think, is the time element.
Right, right.
His entire first term in office was the result he was under indictment. We're looking at probably another few more months, if not longer, where he's going to remain an indictment. Yeah. I can't even imagine when he goes through the process of the trial beginning, let alone being convicted. So from Ken Paxton's perspective, he should probably want this done with earlier rather than later in the term.
Yeah.
And so I think for going forward for him, he wants this over. And so he should probably not be, I think, celebrating about this.
I think so, too. I mean, politically, we saw it didn't make that much of a difference. I mean, he got reelected, although obviously Justin Nelson was one of the top vote getters and got as close as any other Democratic statewide official. So there's some slight resistance there, but it's not clear politically it's a major down for him. Let's talk about Paxton in a different context, and that is that he is, and his office has advised the rest of the government, including a member of the legislature, Eric Johnson from Dallas, about a Confederate plaque, which we're still fighting about, that's in the Capitol.
That's right, Brandon. There's been a longstanding plaque as you enter the Capitol building in Austin that essentially sort of fundamentally misstates the origins of the Civil War, the actions around the Civil War. And Attorney General Paxton has essentially said, look, you can take that off. We don't need a separate legislative action. The governor's able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the plaque. It's called the Children of the Confederacy Creed, which is really unusual. Yeah, and as you say, it's historically inaccurate. And many have called it offensive, including Eric Johnson, who said that he wants it taken down. The Paxton's opinion essentially says the ledge could do that, or the Historical Commission can do it, or the Preservation Board can do it. It's going to come down. The only question is when. And to me, the kind of puzzle is why it hasn't come down yet, given the fact that there's been so many of these in the last year. So this is an unusual event, but I'm guessing it's going to come down.
Yeah, I mean, I you can understand they probably thought they weren't sure who had the authority to do it. This is not that uncommon. Essentially, they don't need a separate bill to go out and get it done.
Right.
They can just simply take it down.
Yeah.
They
just get a crowbar and let Johnson go to town on it, right? Well, another thing that's coming down is, unfortunately, the amount of money that Texas is spending on kids with autism, Jay. The reports this week suggest that Texas is spending about $60 less than it was in 2012. That's about $484 in 2012, down to about $412 this year. That's a 15% drop, despite the fact that the report suggests potentially that there are more children who need this.
Yeah, this goes to what we talked about as sort of a longstanding problem, identifying children who have special education needs. And it's one of the worst possible reasons, all to save a buck. We know that we underinvest in education generally. We know that we have been playing fast and loose in terms of the application of the rule of law in identifying and funding special education needs. This is just one more example. I will say this because I've said it again. The least reported story, the least talked about, is how bad state government offices, from an administrative perspective, are operating. We've had problems in almost every major agency, and no one seems to pay any attention to it.
You put your finger on it. Special ed has been a problem. foster care, and the foster care system has been a problem. Today, reports come out that says that there's been a 10% increase in children without health care in the state. So the ledge obviously is going to meet in January. So the question is whether or not they're going to deal with any of these issues. And it's an interesting dynamic. And I think, like you say, very troublesome. We'll see if they're going to be able to come together with more Democrats. Maybe there's going to be a push. I just have to hold my breath on that. Right.
Well, Brandon, you probably didn't get your fill of elections through the midterms. We still have one more, at least down here in the Houston area. Down in Texas, we have a special election for Senate District 6. Senate District 6 was held by Sylvia Garcia, who is now a member of Congress. And you've got four candidates for a special election. Kind of really two that we want to spend some time and talk about. Carol Alvarado, who is a state representative, and Ana Hernandez, who's also a state representative, both in that district. Both well-regarded. Alvarado's been there, I think, quite a bit longer. And I would say is probably very much the front-runner in this race. She had run a spirited race against Garcia when Garcia first won. She's got to be the front-runner, has most of the support money-wise, certainly from folks in Austin, but is a long-term fixture. And in full disclosure, I used to work with her in the Lee Brown administration.
Interesting, yeah.
We are longtime friends.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, this has been a race, unfortunately, like lots of special elections that haven't gotten a lot of attention from voters. I think in part because we've got election fatigue, right? But at the same time, this is really important because this is going to be the person who represents that district in the Senate. But we've also got some interesting effects happening up north in Dallas. In House District 108, there has been a requested hand recount of ballots. This is a race for 108, and this is essentially a woman challenging Morgan Meyer, who is the incumbent representative. This challenger, Joanna Katnash, has essentially requested that there be a recount. There are a difference of 440 votes, Jay, less than 1% of all the ballots cast, so really close.
Yeah, this is another one of those districts in the Dallas area that had looked like it could potentially flip. This is that close.
Very close.
We've got a similar one down here in the Houston area in 138, Dwayne Bohack.
Yeah.
Barely hung on by less than 50 votes.
Crazy,
after
right?
after the counting. And so you've got a whole slew of these things. There's about 22 districts plus or minus 10% this session. So looking ahead to 2020, there's going to be a lot of House races up for grabs in just two more years.
And you know what? For anybody who says, you know, my vote doesn't count, then look at these races that are decided by less than 1,000 votes, right? That's literally a neighborhood. So get out there and vote. It's important.
Well, Brandon, I am a proud University of Texas alum, and
you don't say.
I am.
You haven't bragged about that for
and
at
one
least
of my
25
one of my
minutes.
Fondest traditions was going on watching UT play Texas A&M
and losing to A&M.
No,
at football.
We have won every time. I was, you know what? UT usually beats A&M, especially on Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving.
At least they have on Thanksgiving. Now that tradition's been gone since A&M left for the Southeast Conference. It's been 7 years since the game's been played. Lyle Larson, a state representative,
proud Aggie, right?
And very proud Aggie, said that bill is important, needs to come back. I think his phrase was, after another Thanksgiving without this game,
he can take no more.
And the irony of this is A&M plays what might be one of the most talked about games of the last decade, this 70-72 come from behind, seven overtime victory over LSU.
That's funny.
A top 10 team. And Lyle Larson is putting this out there. He's got Aggies mad at him. You got people in Austin and Texas Longhorns saying, I don't really care anymore.
Yeah.
Is this fun? But it got viral and people were talking about it. And I guess that's what he wanted.
Well, one of the things the bill does is to dock a university from awarding athletic scholarships or similar assistance by state funds if they didn't participate. I look this up, Jay. The top two biggest generating revenue athletic programs in the country are, guess what, University of Texas and Texas A&M University. Almost $200 million generated per year for each school. That's a lot. They don't need the state's money for that. But I'm in favor of this, Jay. I mean, I don't have any brisket in this competition, but I would love to see the old Southwest Conference back, right? Let's put UH back in there, right? Let's get some of these games mixed up. I think we should maybe just go further and mandate that A&M and UT be in the championship game every year, right? And also that Oklahoma never is in it. So
I would second that.
The rest of these states, you can fight out the other two spots, but A&M and UT every year in the championship
game.
Well,
you know what I'm surprised about is you don't have, you know, Jerry Jones or Bob McNair, resting in peace.
Yeah.
Would pony up $1 million, $2 million, and all the money goes to charity and have these guys play every year.
That is a good idea, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, Brandon, let's talk the big race that we know is going to come. Brandon, you thought we were done with Beto Mania. It's only getting warmed up. Beto O'Rourke announced, well, I guess sort of announced, that he's back thinking about the idea that he might be running for president of the United States. What do you think about that?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, you know, he's electric, right? He stimulated Democratic turnout in Texas in a way we hadn't seen for 20 years. It's a long haul, though, right? And he's obviously a player in this. A couple of things I think worth questioning. And I want to start with this. He said he wouldn't do it. I mean, he was definitive on camera saying he would not run for president. So one worry is that he's now just another politician who goes back on his word. His whole brand was about Texas, serving the people of Texas in a way that Ted Cruz wasn't. That was a moment that he captured. And clearly, lightning in a bottle is difficult to get anyway, but twice, much more challenging. So what do you take on this point about, like, the problematic element of him going back on his word effectively?
Yeah, I don't think it's as much of an issue as you do. I think the context of that response was, you're going to get elected to the Senate and then you're going to run for president. I take it differently, that the fact that he lost, it's a different set of circumstances for him. And I don't think people are going to hold that against him. I think the mechanics, as you talk about, in terms of the ability to run, is interesting to me. What he does well is this retail style of politics, sort of this crowdsourcing style of politics. Yeah. It really fits well. I mean, there's like 90 counties in Iowa.
Right.
He could do that in his sleep.
That's a weekend, right?
Yeah, it's a weekend.
I was going to ask you, how do you even drive to every of the 50 states?
now, I mean, like
in the minivan, right?
Well, 17, like, there's like a massive number of the counties are all here in Texas. But if you think about it this way, right? I mean, what he does well works for Iowa, works for New Hampshire.
Right, right.
Those are the first two. Now, you couldn't do this in California. I think it's impractical for him.
Right.
But he may not need to get there at that point. I think the overarching issue for Democrats is this. Right now, the lane for this sort of progressive center is kind of empty. You've got people on the far left, and you've kind of got, you know, Michael Bloomberg or someone else out there. And I think there's an opening for him. And he, as you said, he's electric. You know, he can energize young voters. He's shown that he can do that. I think it makes sense for him. The alternative for O'Rourke is to run against John Cornyn in 2020 for Senate. We've talked about this before. John Cornyn, assuming John Cornyn runs and does not retire, and I know there's some rumors out there, that's a difficult haul for him.
Right.
I think John Cornyn may be more unpopular than Ted Cruz, certainly among Republicans.
Right.
But he doesn't elicit the kind of hostility that Ted Cruz does.
Right.
And so I think in an ironic sort of way, he might have an easier time running for president than that. And here's the thing to remember. If Beto O'Rourke is a Democratic nominee for president, the state of Texas is in play.
Right.
And I would put my money that he could beat Donald Trump in Texas.
Yeah.
If he could beat Donald Trump in Texas, we don't have a presidential election anymore.
Right.
The race is effectively over.
Well, my issue is about Texas, and that is the state Democratic Party has been trying to get good quality candidates like O'Rourke to run. And if he leaves the state to run for president and potentially win but maybe lose, then it like robs the state party of that option. There's also a danger, I think, in peaking too early. I mean, for this kind of race, remember Howard Dean in 2005, right? He also had the same kind of awesome grassroots support, raised a bunch of money online, the first to do so. And he peaked so early that effectively other candidates came in. You talk about this lane he wants to occupy. That can work, but it's going to be a crowded field. So I think still the ground is a little soft on this, but I do believe that, you know, he's clearly a player in this. I'm just not sure that it's sort of the same natural ascendancy that we're going to, you know, otherwise assume that he had here in Texas when he was, you know, so much voltage that he brought to the race.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer and dark horse candidate for president, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer and independent candidate for the U.S. presidency, Todd Holstein.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.